From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Russian entrepreneur Viktor Bout is the world's most notorious arms trafficker. On today's Underreported, Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, authors of The Merchant of Death, an article in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine, explain how Mr. Bout got to be so powerful and why he hasn't been stopped. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hi.
Hi. Hi.
So what exactly does Viktor Bout do? This is a man who's been described as the postman. Is that what he does? He delivers...
Delivers the mail.
He delivers the mail?
And anything else that clients want. I think the unique thing about Viktor Bout is that he was able to, in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War, as the old world system sort of ended, immediately turn himself into a functioning capitalist entrepreneur whose main things to offer were weapons and airlift capacity. And he was able to parlay that into the ability to supply multiple sides of the same conflict in different regions around the world, and in the process become indispensable to some organizations and make a fortune for himself.
Doesn't he also ship legitimate goods?
He does. He ships everything from, or has shipped everything from tulips to fish, and it's part of the code of the air transporter, if you will. Always make sure that you have at least something on board that you make money on. But a good bulk of those cargoes over the years have been arms.
I was surprised to learn that he's turned flowers into such a lucrative crop. He buys gladiolas in South Africa for $2 and then sells them in the United Arab Emirates for $100?
That's what one of his main partners claims, and he certainly made a lot of money doing that. I think it's also important to point out on the legitimate business side that a huge amount of his business has come from the United Nations, and then, as the article points out, in more recent times, for flying for KBR and Halliburton and the U.S. military into Iraq.
So he has respectable clients along with the ones we might expect, the revolutionary leaders and the third world dictators.
Yeah, he doesn't choose sides. That's his MO. He'll work for legitimate governments. He has worked for warlords in Africa. He has helped arm the Taliban in Afghanistan. He'll take all sides.
So, and doesn't it bother some of the clients, like the UN and the US, that he has been? He has offered his services to some of the people who are on their criminal lists?
Well, you would think it would, wouldn't you? But I think that the truth is, in some cases, he has been indispensable to getting a job done quickly because of his airlift capacity. He has had, at least in the past, up in the upper 50s, the number of aircraft he owns and could operate. And he was reliable. He would get the job done. And so what people will tell you who worked with him was that it is extraordinary because everyone knew that he was working multiple sides of the same conflicts, particularly in Africa. What has become more disturbing to sectors inside the U.S. government was the U.S. military's unwillingness to cut its ties to him in the Iraq operation long after there were other people in line who could do what he did. Even if one assumed or bought the argument that he was needed in the early days, they kept him on long after it was legal and long after it was necessary.
How did Bout get started as a postman?
Well, that's where it gets murky. He has talked very little about his past, understandably. The best that we've been able to see and intelligence agencies around the world have been able to gather, he came up with the Soviet military as the young man. He's still fairly young, believed to be 40 or in his early 40s. He came through a Soviet language training school. He speaks about four languages fluently. And the school has been tied to the GRU, which is the old Russian military intelligence system. So it's believed that he has had and continues to have contacts with that organization.
And when he was still a young man, in the late 80s, he worked as a translator for UN peacekeepers in Angola, didn't he?
Well, that's part of the myth. It's not entirely clear because our research showed that there were, in fact, no Russian soldiers in Angola at the time that peacekeeping soldiers there, but he did work extensively, or at least some in Angola, which during the Cold War was one of the main Soviet client states in Africa, and it would make sense. They also had Antonovs and Illusions and things that from the Soviet fleet, and it makes sense that that would be one of the first places he went when he began his business in Africa, and in fact it was, and he was arming the Angolan government, and then in fairly short order also began arming the UNITA rebels who were fighting him. In fact, did a lot of business with Jonas Savimbi and the UNITA forces there. But at the same time, he was working for the government, and that did cause a bit of bad blood at one point there.
Yeah. One thing you've got to, when you look at him, he took advantage of two commodities that became instantly available at the end of the Cold War. One was the weapons. I mean, all across Russia, but also all across the Eastern Bloc, there were vast, vast stores of AK-47s and all sorts of materiel that was instantly available, no longer for ideological reasons, but now for profit. And the other was airplanes. The Soviet Union had created a monstrous air industry of all of these Antonovs and Ilyushins, these just massive capacity cargo planes. And after the Cold War ended, they were basically stranded in airports all across the Soviet Union, and now Russia. And these became very easy to be picked up for a song or by other means. He created this massive air wing, 50-60 planes.
So. Where did he get the money to pick up the first ones for a song?
Always a good question.
Well, that's unclear. He says that he, for $120,000, bought his first aircraft. Others say that they were, in fact, given to him by Russian intelligence, the GRU, the military intelligence, who had access to the weapons and access to the planes, and realized as their old clients kept coming and seeking weapons that they could, in fact, turn this into a money-making proposition quite quickly. And in Russia, a lot of the weapons factories have airstrips built into them, so you could land there, load up, and do door-to-door delivery essentially fairly quickly. And as Steve said, there was right after the Cold War, there was nothing to do with these weapons. There was nothing. There was just sort of sitting there, and the aircraft were rotting on the airstrips. And so, with a little bit of money, he was able to, or a little bit of backing and permission to take the planes. If he didn't actually spend any money, he could load them up with weapons. They took the GRU folks behind him took their cut of the profits, and then fairly soon after that, in a couple of years, he figured out that he could make twice as much money by flying back full, and he got into the diamonds and into the timber and into coltan and all the other things that he began transporting, fish, flowers, because essentially the flight was paid round trip, and if he took something back in an empty airplane, it was pure profit.
My guests are Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, authors of The Merchant of Death, which is in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine. We're talking about Victor Bout, B-O-U-T, who is probably the world's greatest arms dealer, and I assume that there were international restrictions on who could buy and sell all of the stuff that we're talking about.
Well, there have been, since the end of the Cold War, there have been a number of efforts by the great powers to deal with this endless stream of small arms that are the real meat and potatoes of any revolution or military operation that goes on around the world. And they have had some success. I mean, they've created some regulations that supposedly cover the shipping of these items. The problem is that The regulations have never, number one, there's very little enforcement behind them, and two, they ultimately leave it up to the discretion of customs people on the borders and nations ultimately that don't have strong police forces to deal with this, and as a result, documents are easily forged. Shipping documents are easily forged. Planes are not registered in the places where they need to be heavily scrutinized, and you can create these ghost airlines essentially that move from nation to nation. They switch tail numbers. They switch companies. They at a moment's notice they can completely transform a plane, a company, whatever.
Is it true that the Belgian government issued an international arrest warrant for Victor Boot?
Yeah,
there is an Interpol arrest warrant out for him, but he's happily ensconced in Moscow, traveling occasionally and not being bothered. On the earlier point, one of the things that I found most fascinating in this is that to register his aircraft, he initially went to Liberia, and the Liberian government had in fact rented out their aircraft registry function to two of Boot's friends who were living in England, and they would register your aircraft and give you airworthiness certificates without ever seeing the aircraft or ever doing any inspections on them at all. They were guys at a computer in London certifying all of Boot's planes, but in the international scheme of things, that was enough. They were actually legally registered there. It was quite stunning.
Right, and what that allowed Boot to do is it allowed him to evade scrutiny because a lot of his planes would not be based in Liberia. They would be based in places like the United Arab Emirates or, for a while, South Africa, or even for a while in Belgium. And what would happen is that the airport officials in those countries or the aviation officials would basically throw up their hands because the planes were registered somewhere else and they had essentially no legal scrutiny or no legal muscle to go in and shut them down.
Now, why would the Russians resist turning him over to the Belgian government? Did they benefit in some way from his business?
Well, that's one of the great mysteries, I think. He clearly came out of the Russian intelligence establishment, and there is a great deal of – there was strong feelings within the CIA as well as the European intelligence services looking at him in the late 90s that he was clearly still very protected very high up in the Russian intelligence establishment, and there was some thought that some people very close to Putin, if not Putin himself, were – making sure this happened. And I think part of the dynamic here is that he is an incredibly useful person to have around, both for the United States and in Iraq initially, and for the different things that Russia or its allies want to get done. And so they're not willing to pay the price of putting him out of business, and I think part of that is that they like to keep him around in case they need him again.
So should I assume he's never sold weapons to the Chechens, even though he is willing to sell to all sides?
I think that is not necessarily a true assumption. There are reports of him flying in and out of Chechnya, especially in the early 90s. And so I don't think you can ever rule out him having dealt with anyone.
My guests are Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, the co-authors of The Merchant of Death, an article in the current issue of Foreign Policy about Victor Boot, the Russian entrepreneur who makes a lot of money on flowers and frozen chickens and timber, but most of it on illicit arms sales, or sometimes even legal arms sales. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, who have collaborated on an article called Merchant of Death in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine. Mr. Farah is a former Washington Post foreign correspondent and a terror finance consultant and author of Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. Stephen Braun is a national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and the two of them are collaborating on a book about Victor Boot, which will be published next year. How does one get in touch with Victor Boot?
Well, these days you don't. The only two Western journalists have had any access to him. One was a Belgian magazine reporter who found him in the bush in the Democratic Republic of Congo and spent a week with him because they were sort of stuck together. And the other was Peter Landesman of the New York Times magazine, who got one interview with him, and that was essentially it for Victor Boot. He essentially said he wasn't going to talk to journalists again after that.
But if I wanted to buy arms...
Oh, if you wanted to buy arms.
Do I just Google him?
I think that there is a network. We dealt with several weapons traffickers who know Boot and have dealt around him, and they seem to have the capacity to communicate among themselves quite easily. So I don't think if you were in that milieu and talked to more than two or three people, it would be hard to find a way to place an order.
He'd find you. If you
Is he the biggest guy in the business, or does he have some serious competitors?
Well, he's in terms of the movement of contraband arms, there may well be others who put together spectacular individual deals. But over the course of the last decade, in terms of just on and off movement of this material, there's really nobody that compares. And what he has that no other arms trafficker, if you will, has is this airlift capacity. You know, others have to rely on small private air forces or him. He has the ability to move anything from crates and crates of you know, millions of rounds of ammunition to disassembled helicopter gunships. And it's that airlift capacity that he has that gives him the muscle that no other trafficker can duplicate.
And he also delivered tsunami aid in 2004 and flew peacekeepers to Somalia for the UN.
That's right.
Does the UN pay as much for aid shipments as revolutionaries pay for weapons?
I think the main thing is not to fly empty. I think that he consistently got his UN contracts by bidding lower than anyone else, in part because his maintenance was less, and you had so many Russian pilots who were unemployed, he could pay someone $900 a month, and they were extremely happy, one, to have a job at all, and two, to get out of the Russian winters and be elsewhere, that his labor costs were quite cheap. And the Russian aircraft were built to work in much more difficult and strenuous conditions than many other aircraft were, and particularly the American-made Boeings and things. The Antonovs could land in these crummy, small, unasphalted dirt strips in the middle of Africa and survive. And he also coated the noses of some of his aircraft in lead so that when they were shot at, they wouldn't go down. And it was in one of those planes that he rescued Mobutu Sese Seko from Zaire as Kabila was coming in and then rapidly changed the name to Democratic Republic of Congo. But the plane got shot up, but the hull didn't get pierced because it was covered with lead. So he offers a range of services.
Right.
And he makes trips for the UN to the same areas he's already sold weapons to, weapons that are stirring up the conflict in the first place.
Yes, well, we have one anecdote in the story where he flies in, one of his aircraft flies in food aid for the World Food Program into a refugee crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and then they climb up the ladder, take off the World Food Program logo, it's magnetically onto their tail, load up weapons, and fly off from exactly the same airstrip. So, yes, they're multi-purpose.
And he's violated UN arms embargoes. Are there any penalties for that sort of thing?
Well, they have actually indicted only one person, not him, for violating those goals. But by and large, what they tend to do is they've adopted these name and shame reports. They have Security Council panels, and what they do is they go and they document fairly well the flight patterns of these planes, how they go about doing what they do. And what the UN has been relying on in recent years is they can't indict him for these violations, but what they try to do is to put together a sanctions campaign where they try to freeze his assets. That was done in regards to Liberia because Boot was believed to have relations with Charles Taylor, the former dictator there. And just recently, in early November, in the DRC in Congo, they've also named him with a new group of sanctions.
And the U.S. has contracted Boot to fly missions to both Iraq and Afghanistan? So our U.S. tax dollars are going towards paying Boot for shipments to these countries?
That is correct. Millions of dollars.
Millions of dollars.
What happened was, it's still somewhat murky, but the way we contract, military contracting, they weren't given explicit warnings about this guy, and what they began to do was to hire firms to move material in, and they had to do it fast and quickly, and they didn't want to ask questions. And so what they ultimately did was they began to hire firms that then hired him as subcontractors. And as a result of that, there wasn't much scrutiny, and there were hundreds upon hundreds of flights that occurred between 2003 and 2005.
And this to a man who, you point out, did a lot of business with the Taliban. Seems to me we've located the weapons of mass destruction. It's Victor Boot.
Well, that is certainly, you know, one of the really interesting things was at the end of the Clinton administration, they had actually become very aware of him, and next to Osama bin Laden, he was the highest priority for putting out of business because, as one of the NSC staffers from that time told us, you had AIDS, you had the Al-Qaeda attacks on the embassies in East Africa, and you had Victor Boot as your transnational problems, and that's sort of how he was viewed at the time, and the Bush administration took a much less interest in the Boot phenomenon and the non-state sort of transnational crime phenomenon and began focusing again on states as had traditionally been done, and Boot sort of got off the hook at that point. But it is fascinating that he is able to do this, and one of the big concerns and one of the things that remains, I think, unanswered, but both the British and the Belgians investigated extensively, is whether Boot was one of the people working for the AQ Khan network, and that's never been established, but he was in enough of that milieu to be under suspicion.
He was the major supplier for the Taliban. Could the Taliban have taken over Afghanistan without his supplies?
Well, they relied largely on Pakistan for their heavy armaments, tanks and the sort of ubiquitous pickup trucks that they drove around with gun mounts on them.
But the United States, to some degree, was supplying the Taliban because we have been a major supplier to Pakistan, haven't we?
Well, they would mostly provide them with Russian-built equipment, actually, not ours. But early on, when the Taliban started, they, you know, like any new country that was potentially facing, military movements, they wanted to make sure they had as many sources of material as they could get. And so while they did rely on the Pakistanis, that material that was coming in was pretty much directed by the Pakistanis, and it could be stopped in any moment. So they wanted they needed their own sources. And so that's why they looked elsewhere. And
one of the things that in the book that Steve had reported on before is the fact that he sold them their small air force, the Taliban Air Force, after they actually took over. He sold them about 10 aircraft, which allowed them to move people back and forth, particularly to the United Arab Emirates, and pick up weapons and all kinds of stuff and move them back and forth. And that would not have probably been possible without Victor Boot sales.
It gave them, again, their own small airlift capacity.
And, of course, Victor Boot was also selling to the Northern Alliance, and I assume was shipping narcotics for both sides as well to pay
belief.
For it all.
That is indeed the belief, but that's never been clearly established, but intelligence agencies, law enforcement have long suspected his planes of moving some of that material.
He also lost a plane in Belize, a plane that was coming up from Colombia to Mexico that was loaded with drugs and crashed in Belize, and it was traced to him. So he seems to do some narcotic stuff, certainly.
My guests are Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, who have written The Merchants of Death, an article in the November-December issue of Foreign Policy magazine. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Thought I'd also pass this on to you. We have just learned that Ed Bradley of 60 Minutes has just died of leukemia. He was 65. This was his 25th season as a correspondent on 60 Minutes, and we will give you more details in the newscast at the top of the hour. So we have this man who is, I guess, is seen as a convenience by all the powers of the world. But you said that Clinton went after him. The U.S. Treasury Department froze his assets at one time. Do we have any idea of what effect that had on him?
Well, we know that within several days of that move, they apparently were able to stop at least several million dollars of funds that were in being routed around the world. So it was quickly effective in that manner. But in other ways, it was not very effective. His planes continued to fly for the U.S. government for months after that freeze was enacted, which gives you a sense of the sort of schizophrenic nature of the way our agencies sometimes work.
Did things change at all after 9/11 when more attention was paid to airplanes flying around the world?
Well, one of the fascinating things that's in the book is that right after 9/11, one of Booth's main henchmen, Kenyan named Sanjivan Rupra, had extensive correspondence with his handler at the FBI, offering Victor Booth services in arming the Northern Alliance, and proposed a multi-million-dollar program for aiding the U.S. to go after the Taliban on behalf of Victor Booth. And it's quite stunning because we have some of the correspondence back and forth, and then he was clearly encouraged in this by his handler, who wrote him back saying business will be good for you, etc. So yes, he received more scrutiny, but not to shut him down, but rather to hire him and use him.
Can we assume that he's helping the resurgent Taliban in Afghanistan now?
It's unclear. We do know that he was flying regularly for United States companies into Bagram Air Force Base, which you can't fly into without military clearance, as late as late 2005. That apparently has begun. That has finally stopped. But it's unknown. I mean, his that's the thing. His planes can fly fairly surreptitiously at night into, and they've been known to do this, into Afghanistan, fly into these airstrips high in the Khyber Mountains. I mean, who knows? It's quite conceivable. It wouldn't be quite to his benefit if he wants to continue working for the United States.
But where the U.S. military is pretty sure he has been flying is into Somalia and the resurgent Islamic, the Union of Islamic Courts there. They had a bizarre incident in the middle of July where two Ilyushin 76s, which are very large aircraft, landed in Mogadishu, an airport that hasn't been used for 10 years, offloaded huge amounts of weapons, and took off. And the U.S. military in the Horn of Africa is quite sure that those were Victor planes there, and that's another radical Islamist group.
What would happen if he were put out of business? Would there just be others ready to take his place? Could we ever eliminate this kind of trafficking?
Well, I think that if he were put out of business, it'd be hard for anyone else to replicate his network and the access he had for both sophisticated weapon systems as well as, you know, the run-of-the-mill AK-47s and RPGs and things. The fact that he could deliver attack helicopters on very short notice to Charles Taylor and that sort of thing would be very, I think, hard to replicate. But putting it out of business, I think, is very difficult because it's very low on the international priority level, and it's also not something a lot of people actually want to see happen. And when you can do things like Victor Boot did, which was fly 37 flight loads of weapons from Bulgaria to Togo, a tiny little town, a city in West Africa, with an army of about 1,500 people, and he delivered 10 times more weapons than people in the army, for an army that has traditionally been armed by the French, and these were Soviet weapons, and nobody asked why, and nobody took the initiative to say, gee, does this sale actually make sense? Why would Togo need that? No one checked the end-user certificates. They were all falsified. And until you begin to have minimal will and minimal desire to stop this, it'll never stop.
But I understand the arms trade is not as lucrative as it's been. I read that in the last 18 months, the price of an AK-47 in the Niger Delta has dropped from $250 to $75.
Well, that's true in West Africa, certainly. The flood of weapons, partly provided by Boot, is supply and demand, and the demand is now rather outweighing the demand or bringing the prices down. But I think that that's probably not true in other parts of Africa, and it probably won't be true for that long. It'll be cyclical, and when they use up their weapons and ammunition, they'll be coming back for more. And in the meantime, there is still a lot of legitimate business, and maybe that's why you see Boot venturing out to Somalia and elsewhere in search of new marketplaces. It's like when the cigarette business was hit in the United States, they immediately began marketing in Asia and Latin America to keep their profits up, and he may just be diversifying his portfolio.
But you also say he is the prototypical modern-day multinational entrepreneur, and I get the sense that he probably could make it as a legitimate businessman if he wanted to.
Well, I think that's an interesting thing. There was a possibility he could have done that, yes. And I think he's clearly a very, very smart man, and he's clearly very, very good at business. And I think if he had put his mind to legitimate business, he'd be a very wealthy, legitimate businessman.
You can read the article that we've been discussing, The Merchant of Death, from Foreign Policy Magazine, free by going to our show page at WNYC.org. Just one more thing. If you were able to research this man as well as you have, why can't others, why can't law agencies also research him and go after him as a result? Is it simply because he is seen as a convenience and nobody really wants to go after him?
Well, I think part of it is priorities. When he really rose as an international target, he rose at the very time that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda also emerged as major troublemakers in the world. And as a result, while he was seen in certain corners of the government as someone that we really needed to deal with, ultimately, attention was always paid to the larger and the more appropriate threat at the time.
Will your book also be called The Merchant of Death?
Yes, it's Merchant of Death. That is the name.
And it's coming out when
spring.
Next year?
We don't have an exact pub date, but in the spring.
We want to thank you both so much for talking with us, Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun. Their article, The Merchant of Death, in the current issue of Foreign Policy Magazine, also available if you go to our webpage at WNYC.org.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.